Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, SiriusSeats podcast about food and life, now with an expanded menu. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Alt, SiriusSeats' chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a serious eater like you has sent us.
If you really put your food processor through a workout regularly, just get two separate blades and have one of them as kind of like your beat-up blade and the other one as your sharp blade.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest, back with us, Claudia Fleming, pastry chef goddess, cookbook author, and former innkeeper.
The inn was the little money pit, and it was a little like The Shining.
And finally on today's podcast, a teachable moment in the Sirius Eats test kitchen.
Grilling pork chops can present similar problems as chicken breast. The meat is lean and prone to drying out, even with the slightest overcooking. With a few simple steps, though, you can pretty much guarantee that your pork chops will be juicy and perfect every time.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Alt. And Kenji, our question of the week comes from Joan Moore. How long should the blade on my Cuisinart last? I regularly put it through a workout. Doesn't it depend on what she means by regular and what she means by workout?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like a knife, you know, like the blade on a by Cuisinart she means a food processor. So spinning, it has two little spinning blades that are kind of curved. If all you're doing is chopping fresh herbs and maybe making dough with it, it'll last a really long time. If you're using it to crush nuts or make pesto, it's not going to last nearly as long. If you do what I do sometimes, which is like make like an olive salad and accidentally leave some olive pits in there, then like it barely lasts at all because those olive pits get jammed on there and they scrape up against the plastic and it ruins your blade. But anyhow, the answer is really you just have to feel the blade and carefully feel it, see if it's still sharp, or just sort of monitor how it's doing it. Like if you put some fresh herbs in there and instead of chopping them, it ends up kind of like smearing them around or just grinding them up. That probably means your blade needs to be at the very least sharpened by a professional or just replaced.
And you can't sharpen a Cuisinart blade at home, can you?
It's difficult, and it depends. You know, some of them are serrated, and you can't really resharpen a serrated blade.
Right.
Some of them are just smooth, and those ones you can. But you know, it's still difficult, even if they are smooth, it's difficult.
Yeah, because they're a weird shape.
Yeah, because they're curved. Yeah. What I would recommend is like if you really put your food processor through a workout regularly, just get two separate blades and have one of them as kind of like your beat up blade and the other one as your sharp blade. So keep the sharp one just for chopping herbs and vegetables and things that you know aren't going to dull it, and keep the dull one for pounding nuts and spices and doing all those things that doesn't require like a super sharp blade, mm-hmm. And where you're not going to have to really worry about banging it up because the blade is already banged up.
Got it.
It's the same. You know, it's like I have like a knife that's like my beat up knife at home that like I know that like I don't really care if it's going to get like a little ding in it. It's, I have my sharp knives and then I have my knives that I'm going to be like hacking through chicken bones and don't really care about resharpening too frequently.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think Joan's in good shape. Maybe she'll check in and she'll let us know how she's doing with her Cuisinart blades.
I hope so.
We can talk about that. All right, man. I'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is SiriusSeats' chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Do send in your questions to Kenji to specialsauce@SiriusEats.com. Now it's time to hear more from Claudia Fleming. When we last left the intrepid Ms. Fleming, she had chucked it all and moved to the country to run an inn and restaurant with her late husband, Jerry Hayden. Crazy talented cook.
Larger than life.
The fact that you moved out there and then had to nurse Jerry through years of ALS. I can only, you have such an indomitable spirit, but it really must have tested you.
It wasn't indomitable. Or it isn't. No, it gets you.
Yeah.
It gets to you.
So you're up there in the North Fork. You're running an inn, which you've, of course, never done before.
Of course.
You're running a restaurant. You decided that wasn't enough, so then you also started a food truck.
Yeah, and that was purely economic.
Right. It was like you needed another source of revenue.
Yes, exactly.
Especially
another revenue source.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, but I mean, that's a crazy thing to do. Like, was there a fantasy attached to it for both of you?
The restaurant and the inn?
Yeah.
Not for me. For me, it was, you know, I was kind of the it girl when we left, right? Like, I was on top of the world.
You were Little Miss Thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I was very grateful for that. And I felt like I was sort of eclipsing the larger talent in the relationship. Like, Jerry, as you said, is extraordinarily talented. And I never sought that out. It wasn't a goal for me.
Mm-hmm.
He devoted his entire life to being a chef, a cook. And I loved him very much and wanted him to have his time. And I hope that doesn't sound patronizing. I wanted him to live his dream.
For sure.
And I wanted to help facilitate that.
Because you felt like you were already living yours.
I was. And even though it wasn't my dream, I was in a great place.
Right. Got it.
And he, I wanted him to realize that same
place. Yeah, for sure. Got it. So that's what it was for him.
Right.
So you move out there.
For me, I was just trying to be supportive and wanted him to have what I had.
Yeah. So you move out there, and this is before the North Fork of Long Island has become as fashionable as it is today, right? Like, when you guys moved out there, it was very sleepy, full of small second homes of firemen and police and all kinds, because I rented out there back then, and I was like, I remember. It's like, this is not the Hamptons.
Not at all.
It's like they should have had a sign that had Hamptons with a diagonal line through it. You know, like, not the Hamptons.
Yep. Yeah. And he summered out there.
Got it.
So it was always his dream to go back there.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the hardest part of the transition? And or was everything hard?
It was a little money pit. And it was a little like The Shining. You know, it was like,
whoa!
It was kind of crazy. Like, you know, the inn was literally falling down and falling apart, and it was a money pit, and there were lots of hysterical things about that. But it was kind of creepy and scary, too.
Yeah. Especially not in the summer.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I assume it really becomes sleepy in November.
Very.
All the way through, like, May.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Right?
From December, you get a little, you can sort of get through till November. But
got
then
it.
From December till May, it's brutal.
Yeah.
Or it was. It's not so much anymore.
Yeah. Is there any advice you'd like to impart at this moment to anyone considering such a radical move?
Ugh, be well capitalized. That's all I can say. Have a lot of money behind you.
Yeah.
Pit reference. Oh, man.
You know,
it's the biggest downfall of most restaurants, I think.
And not just most restaurants. Serious Eats, I was like, I think I listened to the New York State Lottery commercial, All You Need Is a Dollar and a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that's wrong when it comes to starting a business.
Right.
It may be all you need to win the lottery,
yeah.
But it's not all you need to start a business.
Beware of your passion.
Yes.
It can kill you.
It can kill you. Exactly. So, you know, Jerry was diagnosed with ALS in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Did that just exacerbate the stress you were dealing with in running the inn and the restaurant?
My God.
It must have been like such a stress multiplier.
Kind of a blur, I have to say.
Really?
Yeah. No, the level of stress was insane.
Yeah, because you were having to do more and more.
Mm-hmm.
You were also having to attend to Jerry.
Right.
And then you were also, but then you were also like, well, Jerry can't do this anymore, so I have to hire somebody and then.
Oh, the payroll was astronomical.
Right.
I mean, because he could basically do the work of five people.
Right.
So, and did, as, you know, most owners do, right? So, yeah, like had to have. Two chefs and then, you know, more cooks. And because, of course, he was on the line every night and prepped every day and did just did everything.
Right.
So, it was crazy. And then just trying to be so careful not to come home and complain about it all the time, because he felt just so badly that I was left to have to deal with it all, you know?
I remember seeing you two at the James Beard Awards. I don't know if you remember this. And by that time, he was speaking through one of those tubes. But he was still Jerry. That was the fascinating thing, because he said to me through this squawk box or whatever, I'm sure there's a more technical name, that he wanted me to take him on a barbecue tour of New York. He was still Jerry.
It was unbelievable to me.
And he was in a wheelchair.
Yep.
And you were attending to his every need, and yet his spirit was there.
Never wavered. It was unbelievable. It was, I got my strength from him.
Wow. Wow.
It was, I'm like, how is he doing this? Like, it was just incredible. I'm like, well, man, if he can do it, I can do it with him.
So he actually helped sustain you.
Absolutely.
Wow. Wow.
No question about it.
So he died in 2015. I can only imagine, as we've talked about, what those last few years with Jerry were like. What was the aftermath like? You know, like these last 4 years or 5 years.
Yeah.
I know that's a hard
question. It just kept getting harder and harder. I couldn't sustain it. You know, not only from a financial point of view.
But an emotional point of view, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it was his dream. Like, it's really hard to live someone else's dream.
Especially after they're gone.
Especially after they're gone.
Wow.
I mean, I was there 100% when he was there with me. But, you know, you can't realize somebody else's dream.
No.
It doesn't work. And you become resentful.
And his dream was really much, it was ahead of its time, right? His dream was to do what a lot of chefs are doing now. In a way, it was doing what Dan Barber is doing at Stone Barns, only you guys were doing it
on a dime.
15 years ago on a dime without investors, but you were trying to grow everything and develop relationships with fishermen and farmers.
Absolutely.
And you were doing all that before.
He started a farmer's market in the parking lot of the restaurant.
Wow.
To, you know, because none of the purveyors had retail shops, of course.
Right.
And he wanted very much to share the products that we were able to procure with, you know, other people and give them access to what we had access to. And so invited a lot of our purveyors, many of whom were new farmers. There were a lot of new farmers on the North Fork.
Right.
It was great fun.
It was like California dreaming writ large, right,
yeah.
in its own way, right? Because that was Jerry's dream.
Yep. Yep.
But you soldiered on, right? I mean, it had to have been really hard, not just because you were living somebody else's dream, the financial pressures, and also, what about the time to mourn your husband?
I don't know that that's happened yet. Honestly.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Because there were so many other things to deal with.
Yeah, there wasn't time.
Wow.
It just came at me fast and furious.
Like you just sold the inn and restaurant.
Last week.
I hope that, you know, it does give you the time to do that, because
and reflect on it happily and positively instead of just
seeing it as the ultimate ball and chain.
Yeah. And just being in crisis management mode every day, all day.
Yeah.
You know, and reflect on what we accomplished.
Yeah.
Which was always so hard to do.
I had that experience when I sold Serious Eats, too. It was just like, it was a little bit of PTSD. It's like, I should feel great, but I'm still think I have to worry about payroll.
Yep. Exactly right.
So I can't feel
How
great.
How long did it take?
You're not going to be happy with this answer. It took a few years. I would say it took a solid year, maybe two. But it was that thing that you're talking about. It was just like, I don't know what it's like. The struggle was ever present.
Yeah, yeah. It was your identity.
For sure.
Yeah.
It was totally my identity. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you've sold it. And what's cool is that your rebirth coincides with them reissuing the last course.
How amazing was that?
Like, how did that come about?
Demand, I think. I mean,
Right, because I read that people were paying hundreds of dollars. I didn't know because I would have, like, you could have helped with my son's tuition. I could have sold my copy of The Last Course.
Well, you could have just called me. I would have given you the recipe. That's what a great business person I am. Just call me. I'll give you the recipes for free.
So it was really demand, right? So did you get a call from your agent
Yep, exactly right. I got a call from my agent, David Black, and he's like, Pam Cannon at Random House wants to re-release the book. I'm like, great, let's do it.
That's great. And did you revise or expand it at all?
No, apparently because it wasn't digital.
Got it.
There wasn't a lot of room for re-creating.
Got it.
Because it was going to be prohibitively expensive.
So why is it such a revered book? Let's start with, what were you trying to say with the book?
I think I was trying to make restaurant desserts more accessible by deconstructing them.
Not necessarily making them easier, but by deconstructing them.
Yeah. And by, you know, because the restaurant desserts were, each had several elements. And I thought that each element in and of itself was a dessert.
And could stand on its own. So in other words, a dessert at the restaurant could be a granita with a slice of cake or...
Exactly. And some fruit.
Right.
But any one of those elements is really dessert.
Got it.
You know, after dinner, you know, you have a dinner party, serve granita.
Right.
And store-bought cookies if you want.
Yeah.
You know, it can be... People are so daunted by desserts.
Yeah. And so you want to demystify them, but also, but not by saying, this is easy. First of all, you are, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, you're an obsessive and a perfectionist.
Okay.
And so that's what came through in the book. I remember when it came out. It was everyone was like, well, we know Claudia, we know what her mindset is, and she put it on the page so that you could make the shortbread cookies or, you know, a dark chocolate caramel tart or whatever, and it would be right, and it would work. And it meant you had to be as mindful and precise as you are, though.
And Melissa
Clark was your co-writer.
Yes, and did all the testing.
Right, and she's become a formidable recipe developer and writer.
Amazing.
And best-selling author in her own right.
All those
things.
How lucky
at
was
the New York Times.
Yeah.
But why was it such a revered book? Like, because you talk to any pastry chef. I remember when I introduced Stella Parks, Brave Tart, our pastry wizard.
Yes.
To you at the Beard Awards a couple of years ago, and she was tongue-tied. She was starstruck.
Oh, my goodness.
She was literally like, what? You're going to introduce me to Claudia Fleming? And, you know, Brave Tart is nobody's fool. And she's
That is amazing.
Yeah, she's amazing.
That book is amazing.
Yeah. She's amazing.
Yeah, she is. She's absolutely
unbelievably talented and smart and wonderful human being. And but she was she was just like, okay. And she dropped what she was doing and who she was talking to, and we went over to you when you were plating desserts at the after the
party.
That's the way they serve dessert. Remember at that dinner at the Media Awards, everyone walks around and eats various desserts. But is that why? I mean, do you think it's the precision? Do you think it's your point of view that informs so many, like, multiple generations of pastry chefs to this day?
I think it spoke to the time. You know, the whole local seasonal phenomenon was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I demystified a little bit. But for pastry chefs, I mean, you know, today people put herbs in desserts and use savory things in desserts all the time.
Right.
People weren't doing that
then. No.
And that was a function of being in the kitchen during service, watching cooks and going, I want to do that.
To quote Tom Colicchio, you were thinking like a chef.
Yes. Yeah. And I think maybe I was a frustrated cook. Am a frustrated cook. And so I started making dessert just like another course, right? The last course. And it became less about sweet than about just another course that just wraps up the dinner.
Yeah.
It didn't come out of left field, I felt like.
Give us a sort of quintessential Claudia Fleming example of what you're talking about.
Let's start with a very simple cornmeal pound cake.
Okay.
Sabayon.
Right.
That's made, if not to order, then pretty close to order.
Right.
Caramel in a pan.
Mm-hmm.
Throwing oranges in the caramel, having candied kumquats, throw those on top, having toasted pistachios, garnish with that, having, you know, blood orange sorbet. I mean, I could keep going, right?
Right. Like your mise en place was just as intense. Yeah.
It was insane. And we were always cooking some element of that dessert, whether it was a roasted pear or caramelizing oranges or bananas or whatever the season was. You know, we were cooking something on that plate.
And you were cooking desserts a la minute.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the pound cake was made.
Of the minute. Right.
But,
So you started with the cornmeal pound cake, which is, so then you're starting with, what's the best pound cake I can make?
Correct.
And then you can go from there. You're sort of building layers of flavor like a chef would build a dish.
Exactly right.
Okay. All right. Yep. I get it.
Yep. And a lot of the mise en place for different dishes could kind of
cross-pollinate,
right? Because you have all this mise en place.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, if you got someone special that came in who you know has had all your desserts, you're like, oh, look, I have mise en place from the pear plate that I can just, you know, do this with, play with. So it was a much maybe freer way of playing with dessert.
Yeah, that's cool. So the book's out. You've sold the inn. Mm-hmm. Are you going to move back? You're gonna grace us with your presence?
I'd like to spend a lot more time here, yeah.
Are you going to start making pastries? Like, if I had money, I'd finance a bake shop.
I would.
Claudia Fleming.
I would love to have a bake shop if it didn't have to make money. I'll do anything
a non-profit pastry shop.
Yeah, I'd love to travel and just explore. It's been so long.
Yeah.
I mean, last weekend was my first weekend off in 15 years, I think.
Wow. That's incredible. All right, now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. No pressure.
Okay.
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
Does the husband count as a family?
We'll allow Jerry to be there, but you still have to come up with three more people.
Okay.
It can be living
and
or dead.
And only because he was the best company ever.
All right. You're allowed. I'm actually making what will heretofore be known as the Claudia Fleming exception.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So Jerry Hayden is at the table.
Jerry Hayden.
Three more people, living, dead, artists, musicians, painters, politicians, religious figures. I don't care. It could be anybody.
Okay. Rafa Nadal.
Rafa Nadal. I love it. Nobody said Rafa Nadal.
I'm obsessed with tennis.
I am
the greatest spectator you have ever seen.
But you're not a player?
No.
That's awesome. But Rafa Nadal is a great, because I think
so
even though he's
sweet.
Probably not that interesting, he's such a
How could you say that? He is the most interesting person.
No, I just mean what's fascinating is, what's most interesting about him is how he moves on the court.
It's unreal.
He really, he's a ballet dancer. That's why you like him.
Okay.
And his spirit must remind you of Jerry's
just
spirit.
Just never, ever, ever gives up. Like,
yeah.
Never gives up. And yeah. I'm going to respectfully disagree. He's not a ballet dancer. I would call Djokovic or Federer more ballet dancers. He is just gritty and just gets it done.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And that's a lot of me. I get it done.
Yeah, all right.
And he's really cute. Just for like a big helping of dignity, can we have Barack there?
Of course.
Okay. Would you come and have dinner?
I would.
I'd like to see you and Jerry go at it.
We went at it a few times when he was around. All right.
I think that would be super fun.
All right. But I love the idea of Rafael Nadal and Obama together. That's a great pairing.
You think?
I do. I think that there would be such profound mutual respect.
Oh, for sure.
The question is whether there's enough similar frame of references to sort of facilitate conversation.
Well, I would.
You would supply
that. I would do that.
Okay.
I would do
All right.
that. I would.
So what are you eating?
I think we're going to have some truffle risotto in there.
But not with truffle oil. We're talking...
With what? No. Parmigiano risotto with a poached egg and shaved white truffles
on
top.
Yeah, now we're talking.
Okay.
I like this.
Okay. Some great bread, like fantastic bread. I love bread.
Oh, man, I went to this pizzeria last night I should take you to, Raza in Jersey City. He makes his own bread and he makes his own butter.
Yep.
And then
my very dear friend worked with him for a couple of years.
He's great. And his pizza is amazing. What?
Do you know Kevin Mahan?
No.
He was the GM at Gramercy for
a
lot of years.
That's right. He did. And in fact, he said to me the first time I walked into Raza, I think he was there. And he goes, I know you.
Yep.
That's funny.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. He talks about that place all the time.
No, it's great. It's great. And he also served me some fermented butter last night that tasted like blue cheese.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Wow.
It was awesome.
Ooh, fun.
So, okay. So keep going. So some bread, some risotto. We're a little carb heavy, but it's okay.
Okay, a big salad, big
okay.
giant salad. It's actually kind of a joke how much salad I eat. People
okay.
make fun of me.
And then a dessert.
And then a dessert.
And everyone's going to, be waiting with bated breath for what dessert you're going to be eating.
Cheese.
Wow, out of nowhere, cheese on the outside. That's funny.
And a chocolate bar.
And a chocolate bar.
Yeah.
And really a good chocolate bar.
Oh,
we're not talking
Hershey's. No, we're not
talking
Hershey's.
Okay.
But Hershey's has its place.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
Right.
And what are you listening to? Would there be music there?
I find music a little distracting.
Okay. No music.
Makes
then.
Me always want to sing and dance.
Okay. Do you have guilty pleasures food-wise?
Potato chips. Yeah. And like penny candy.
Preferred brand of potato chips?
I got very attached to North Fork.
Oh, yeah, which are really good.
Yeah, they're really good.
What's interesting is that even some of the big potato chip companies have come out with these small batch. Like Lay's makes a good small batch potato chip now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
oh,
which
okay.
is interesting.
Huh.
And sometimes those companies buy the North Forks
yes.
of the world.
Yes.
So books that have influenced your life. Could be cookbooks. They could be anything.
Well, certainly Nancy Silverton's dessert book.
Right, which, I'm not even sure it's still in print. It's
I don't
an
think
awesome
it is,
book.
But I have three copies.
You have three copies.
Well, Jerry had one. I had one. And then I don't know why we have a third one, but we
Nancy
do.
And Nancy was the founder of Larea Bakery and and the seminal pastry chef.
I mean, she really should be at the dinner, too.
For sure.
Actually.
She should. All right. We're putting Nancy at the table.
Yeah.
And now owns the Mozzas with Joe Bastianich. But two more books.
The food science book from way back.
Oh, Harold McGee?
Harold McGee.
Harold McGee, the in many ways, the godfather to Kenji Lopez Alt.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
well, I know Kenji is,
yeah.
I mean, just an incredible researcher and cook.
Yeah. But, you know, and Harold wasn't as much of a cook. But, you
right.
know, if you
He's
ask
more
Kenji,
of a scientist.
Yeah. Harold is a hardcore scientist. But I think Kenji would say that he was influenced by him, for
and
sure.
Does Kenji have a book?
Yeah. Food Lab is like.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. While you were recovering from the inn and Jerry. He rocked a book big time. Like Food Lab is sold hundreds of thousands of copies.
Oh, my goodness. I'm
it's
sorry.
Crazy.
I don't know that.
No, that's okay. We have to get you.
I was living under a rock as it were.
Yeah. Three things in your kitchen that you can't do without.
My bowl scraper.
Okay.
A whisk.
Right. These are pretty low-tech items.
Oh, super low-tech.
Okay.
I don't do high-tech.
Bowl scraper. Whisk.
Whisk. I guess my KitchenAid, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to work without that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Eggs.
Eggs.
Oh, yeah. I used to say to Jerry, I love you more than eggs. Like, eggs are my favorite. Like, I love eggs so much.
Scrambled soft?
Don't do scrambled so much. I like over easy and poached.
Okay. All right.
Again, with truffles on them, preferably.
Okay.
On like.
This
toast,
is why you had
bread.
Financial problems when you were running in. You were putting truffles in every dish. It's just been declared Claudia Fleming Day all over the world. What's happening on that day?
Oh, wow. Everyone's nicer to each other. Everyone's just. A little more understanding.
It's getting harder and harder.
It's getting
isn't it?
Harder and just more compassionate and just realizing that everybody is going through shit, man.
Yeah.
And you just got to be a little more understanding.
Yeah. Sort of universal empathy. It would be Universal Empathy Day.
Like that person that didn't hold the door open for you. They
right.
are just in their own world. Oh, wait. And this is so huge. And I don't know why. The world doesn't get behind this. Stay to the right. Everybody stays to the right and nobody bumps into each other.
Nobody has ever said that. Everybody has to stay to the right.
And if you stay to the right, you're not going to bump into anybody. It's like driving. Imagine you're in a car all the time. Like, would you just like go straight in front of somebody? No, you wouldn't.
You'd stay to the right.
You'd stay to the right. And when they passed, you would go behind them.
So, wait, I might have to think about this because...
When you are going anywhere, I want to have T-shirts made, stay to the right.
I love it.
Especially in the subway.
Got it. Claudia, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, this was awesome. And if you want to know the genesis of many pastry chefs thinking... Pick up a copy of Claudia's The Last Course, or if you just want to cook something great yourself. It's just been recently reissued, and it's awesome. Now it's time to head over to Serious Eats Test Kitchen to discover what our managing culinary director, Daniel Gritzer, is cooking up. No need to take notes. Details of Daniel's recipe are at SeriousEats.com.
Grilling pork chops can present similar problems as chicken breast. The meat is lean and prone to drying out, even with the slightest overcooking. With a few simple steps, though, you can pretty much guarantee that your pork chops will be juicy and perfect every time. First, you want to brine them. Given enough time, salt breaks down the pork chop's muscle proteins, helping it retain moisture as it cooks, leading to far juicier results. But there are two ways to brine, wet and dry. A wet brine involves dissolving salt and sometimes some sugar in water and then soaking the meat in that solution. Dry brining is as simple as sprinkling salt all over the chops, then letting them rest uncovered in the fridge. You can do each of these in as little as 1 hour, or leave them as much as 1 to 2 days. Tested side by side though, a clear winner emerges, the dry brine. Unlike the wet brine, which leaves the pork chops swollen with liquid, the dry brine and air-dried pork chops develop a drier surface that browns much more quickly and deeply, leading to more flavorful chops by the time they're cooked through. To grill them, start by setting up a 2-zone indirect fire. Place the chops over the hot side of the grill, seasoning with pepper and a little more salt if you want. Then cook them until well-browned on both sides, and they reach 135 degrees Fahrenheit in the thickest part for medium. If they're browned and charred but not quite done in the center, you can move them to the cooler side of the grill to finish cooking. For very thick chops, ones that are 1.5 to 2 inches or even more, you can use the reverse sear, which means starting them on the cooler side and then finishing them on the hot side once they reach about 130 degrees in the center. That'll be enough to brown them on the exterior and get the internal temp just a little bit higher to where you want it. This method can deliver a more evenly cooked interior for thicker chops, but it's not necessary for ones that are thinner. And that's it. Perfectly grilled pork chops that are deeply browned, flavorful, and juicy throughout.
Details of Daniel's recipe and a video are at SeriousEats.com. And that's our program for this week. Next time, Kenji will return to answer your question of the week with his usual scientific precision. And back to culinary school, also known as Serious Eats Test Kitchen. And as always, a conversation with our special guest. I'm Ed Levine. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.